This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
Welcome to John Richardson and the Futurenauts, Book of Revelations. It's episode 47, The Future of Fizzy Drinks. And I'm joined, as ever, by Tinkerbell O'Reilly.
Hello!
And Barry Smells.
Hello!
Mark and Ed, it's good to be with you again.
Yeah.
There's just so much, like, going on with the world and stuff, like, you know, climate and, like, the school run that... what are we on about? Episode 9?
33, episode 9.
I got it. So yeah. I do know.
Yeah, well, sort of.
Yeah, I know it's episode 9. Your names, that's not coming back to me.
I think, do you know what happened there? When you said whatever it was, Tinkerbell O'Reilly, yeah. I was thinking, oh, I'm glad Ed's gone for that one because I don't know, because it's kind of like a bet. Like, what's he going to do next? Is he going to be better or worse? And I thought, Ed's taking it. It'll run out of steam. But then I got Barry Smells, so I should have gone first.
Yeah, I think Tinkerbell O'Reilly's the one.
Yeah.
That is my drag name.
I go and watch a TED Talk by Tinkerbell O'Reilly. Well, some bad news to start. An email from Tim in sunny Kent. Afternoon, gents. Please find attached my invoice for £1,706, which is the immediately ascertainable cost to date of you galvanising my conscience.
Oops.
I'm loving this already.
I am lucky enough to hold some shares and had previously half-heartedly thought about scrutinising those companies through a greener lens, but predictably never got round to it. However, listening to you guys, heeding the call, I did just that and sold my shares in Shell. Needless to say, I'm sure they didn't notice, but if everyone did it, notably pension funds et al., they presumably would. Well, since selling those shares, the fuel crisis has kicked in nicely and they've gone up, with me missing out on the amount listed to date. And to add insult to injury, my own fuel bills have happily ticked upwards likewise. So many thanks indeed. Ho-hum, a small price to pay, I'm sure. Of course, hopefully in a few years' time when others follow suit and the fossil fuel industry becomes a less attractive proposition to the right-minded investor, I'll be able to look back and say I sold at the right time, at which point I will rebate you the £1,700. Honest, the remaining £6 is my admin costs. I continue to spread the word about the podcast to my kids and friends, and you may be interested to hear that my friend Paul also loves it and recommended it to his daughter, whose university now, thanks to her, has your podcast on its pre-reading listening list for some of its modules. I'm not entirely sure what this says about the modern university system, but I think it must be positive, surely. Sterling work. All the best. Tim in sunny Kent.
I'm now fascinated which modules we are pre-reading and listening for.
Yeah. How to swear in a public sphere.
Swearing in the public domain, offensive accents, and yeah, presumably something slightly climatey. Any of you going to stump up the £1,700 for Tim selling his shares in Shell?
I tell you what, I mean, I'm guessing that he listens to this podcast for free, doesn't he? He doesn't pay anything to listen to the podcast.
If he does, then he's getting scammed because I ain't getting any of it.
Exactly.
Tim, if you're paying someone, they are doing you over.
Indeed. And we've done, what is it now, preparation 40 episodes.
Oh, this is the 9th episode of the 3rd series, mate.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, all right,
if you're not aware of it.
Yeah. So really, actually, I would say that you've probably got £2,500 worth of value in terms of content from this, dear listener, and we should send you an invoice. We'll be sending it by return. If you could just send us your address, that'd be great. Thanks very much.
Now, on the topic of people, the sort of backhanded thanks we get, people trying to do the right thing and then regretting it immediately, Chris, the appropriately named Chris Fairweather, has been in touch to say, hello all, I've been enjoying the podcast since the beginning. It's been making me think about my decisions. And although I can't put much into practice at the moment, I've made myself a 10-year plan to bring down my carbon footprint. However, I can't seem to get over the impending boom of climate change, which is making me unproductive in everyday life. For example, I had a great morning today working and then read the headline, last 7 years, hottest on record. And my mind goes, ah, what's the point in trying? There's not going to be a future anyway. And then into the downward spiral of despair. I tell you what, Chris, if you're looking for a birthday present, I've got a tour coming up that it sounds like you are bang in the target market for. Why bother trying to build something now? You mentioned in the last podcast you've come to peace with your work maybe not being completed in your lifetime, but perhaps you could talk about how to deal with climate anxiety. It's starting to become a serious problem in my life, and I guess others feel the same. The appropriately named Chris, not so fair weather.
I think we empathize with Chris. I actually wrote the foreword for a book on eco anxiety by the psychiatrist Anishka Gross,
who's a neighbor of mine, strangely.
Who's a neighbor of Mark's.
This is rather unfortunate because it meant that Ed had an excuse to come round. Now that's eco anxiety for you. Oh god, yeah. Ed's doing a forward for a book. He's doing the book launch. It's around the corner. He's got to come over to my house. As if the climate crisis wasn't enough, now I have to have Ed come round and talk to me about the book he's helped launch.
Exactly. I'll just do an enforced poetry reading at the same time, just to put the icing on the cake. Anishka's book is brilliant, and I think, you know, Chris is wrestling with what a lot of us feel. And, and as he said, Mark alluded to this in terms of, you know, you don't know whether you're going to see the results of your work necessarily within your own lifetime. And for me, one of the kind of standout moments, epiphanies that I've had is this whole sort of psychological idea of terror management theory, which comes from, you know, the idea that we're in constant denial of our own death. And that's the way that we manage our lives, you know, to kind of put aside and displace the inevitable. And we do that through lots of different ways. You know, some of them are spiritual, some of them are material, some of them are behavioural. I mean, shopping is and consumptive behaviour is actually a good example of terror management theory. And I think we also sort of lurch into that a bit when it comes to climate grief, when it can all feel hopeless. You know, I always return back to something that you always say on this podcast, John. It's like you get more motivated and connected by engaging rather than denying. So, you know, if you took the terror management theory in terms of mortality, it's like, well, yeah, you know you're gonna die, but that doesn't mean you don't have an extraordinary, rich and wonderful, creative, productive and happy life in between. Surely that's the point. And so even though there may be some impending doom and it's going to get bumpy, as we always talk about, and it's going to go up and down, it's probably going to get better and worse at the same time, we do everything we can along the way, because, you know, every ton of carbon that doesn't go into the atmosphere alleviates future human suffering and the web of life in some way, shape or form. And, you know, we'll get into that now in terms of talking to Gabriel Walker, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would say that I totally empathise with what Mr. Fairweather is saying.
Good name, by the way, Fairweather. Indeed. To be talking about climate anxiety.
Indeed. And I think we all feel it. And I'll echo what we say on this podcast, which is actually by getting engaged more, you become sort of less anxious because you're tying your own life to doing something about it. So the fact he's made this plan and is starting to get on with it is fantastic. And the other thing I always come back to is the Gandhi quote, which I say a lot on this podcast, which is, you know, what you do will be insignificant, but it's really important that you do it. And, you know, even people I know working at a very high level with huge levers and lots of money, you know, what they do in the grand scheme of things will be insignificant, but it's really important that they do it. And, you know, even by even acknowledging that and talking about it, you know, you're doing a really great thing. So the anxiety itself is an indication that you actually give a shit. People who don't give a shit about climate don't have anxiety about it. So the mere fact that you feel that worry is actually an indication that you're probably doing something right, and you should be a bit kinder to yourself, kind of doing what you're doing. And the more you do that, the more you'll be able to do, the more you're able to do, the more you encourage other people to do things. And the more we all do that, the better chance we have of, you know, getting through this crisis. And just be kind to yourself, but acknowledge that it's a real thing. And actually, you know, why would you not acknowledge it? As Ed said, it'd be like not acknowledging your death, which actually at the end of the day is fairly silly.
Well, a couple of sort of beautifully optimistic responses that both centered around a sort of veiled death threat. Sort of saying, you're a good guy, slap yourself on the back, but I tell you what, mate, you're going to die anyway. so you might as well do your best.
Yeah.
But no, wonderful. And they, you know, I also slightly think, in a way, sometimes when a relationship might not be working and it's easier to think, oh, if I was with someone else, it would be better, rather than to work on the relationship you've got. I think it's slightly rose-tinted. And I think sometimes we all have that moment when we're struggling with the validity of, you know, the efficiency of our climate change actions, to think there are this massive band of people who are chugging around in big houses and massive cars and they're really happy. I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think there's not as many of those people as we think, and you're part of a much bigger team fighting for the solution than those people. You know, it's easy to draw a cartoon image of, you know, a picture of sort of guy with a balding guy with a ponytail on, in a big car chugging around with diesel fumes spitting out, and he's in a sort of leather jacket and a suit. But it is that, it's a cartoon image, and I think those people do have more anxiety about being chased than we think they do. And you made the decisions to live the life you did because you're a good person. So, and this idea that we might as well not try, you would be less happy not trying. So you are making the right choice, even if it doesn't feel that way at the time. But this podcast is part of fighting those anxiety fears head on by bringing you topics like today's, which is concrete action that is being taken by people to make you feel better about the future for the climate. And today we're here to talk about carbon drawdown, which is very exciting.
Yes, carbon drawdown, or carbon removal, more specifically.
Carbon removal.
Yes, and we're going to demystify all this offset nonsense that's going on, and, you know, how we go about that and why we have to do it and how we're going to get from here to there.
It's an exciting topic, is it not?
It is exciting. It's also quite controversial as well. And we're about to listen to an interview where Ed, I think, takes the bit between his teeth and really digs in, gets his most combative, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, oh. I was channeling my inner Paxman.
Yeah. Right, well, let's introduce our guest. And for those regular listeners, you're about to see a different side of Tinkerbell O'Reilly.
Well, it is my enormous pleasure to introduce the wondrous Dr. Gabriel Walker. Now, Dr. Gabriel Walker was, in fact, pretty much the first person that Ed and I invited to be interviewed on the Future Nauts podcast when we did it a long time ago, even before John, pre-John, in 2017. And with typical Future Naut-like efficiency and urgency, bang, 5 years later, she's here on the podcast. So she declares herself a pointy-headed academic scientist. She has a PhD from Cambridge. She's also taught at Cambridge and at Princeton. But she's so much more than an academic. So if you're watching TV around the turn of the century, you would like to have seen Gabriel fronting various documentaries about our atmosphere or the Antarctic, which is a particular obsession of hers. She's been climate change editor at Nature, which for scientists is the equivalent of Rolling Stone. Featured editor at New Scientist. She's the author of numerous books, An Ocean of Air, Snowball Earth, Antarctica, An Intimate Portrait. And with Sir David King, the erstwhile chief scientific advisor to the UK government, she wrote the hot topic, How to Tackle Global Warming and Still Keep the Lights On. This would be impressive enough, but Gabriel's talents go far beyond being able to communicate. She is a massive agent of change, a corporate catalyst, a policy possibilist, an inspiration for investors. What I'm trying to say is that Gabriel is very good at thinking in systems, but also very good at finding the blind spots that people in those systems have, and then directing her and her colleagues' energies to dealing with the tricky, often unseen and often unpopular problems that need dealing with, which means even as committed environmentalists, you will find Gabriel brokering conversations between oil companies, activists, scientists, investors and politicians, sometimes wrangling whole industries into a new way of thinking and doing, bring everyone new and more collaborative perspectives so that we may get on with more rapid collective action on the sustainability and climate change challenge. Her work has taken her to both poles several times. She's climbed trees in the Amazon. She's swum with piranhas. She's been sneezed on by a humpback whale. She's hooked lava out of a live volcano, and she's flown in zero gravity. I have known her for 7 years, and I can tell you she's one of the most well-travelled people you'll ever meet, not just physically, but also philosophically, intellectually, and artistically, which means she can see things from so many angles and get to the heart of matter really quickly. She also makes incredibly good cocktails, knows how to box, has a mischievous streak a mile wide, and her energy levels are off the scale, and I love her, and I'm sure you all will too after our chat today. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gabriel Walker.
Wow, Mark, that was quite the intro.
Yeah, well, I expect a cocktail.
Yeah, we're getting competitive on our intros now, you see. Who can give the guest the most plaudits?
Indeed. See, I just started just doing them very casually, and then Ed started doing them properly professionally and writing one. So I thought I'd better write one, so I did. So there we go. So a car's on the table. Gable's a very good friend of mine. I've known her for years, and she's wonderful. And I'm working with her on this very particular problem, which we want to talk about, Gabriel. You've picked perhaps the most unpopular problem in climate change to deal with, haven't you? Do you want to tell us what it is?
Well, basically, it comes under the category, people call it carbon capture and get a bit confused about what that means. It's basically taking carbon dioxide, the bio-greenhouse gas that is actually causing our problems, out of the atmosphere and storing it somewhere safe. And you can also do carbon capture to stop the CO2 getting into the atmosphere in the first place. You can put it on factory chimneys. You can put it on any places where you've got concentrated amounts of CO2 coming out. So it's basically, it's a mechanism to stop the problem getting worse, and actually also to try and start to make it better. And I've been working on both sides of that, but lately I've been working mostly on the bit which is actually carbon removals, taking the carbon dioxide back out of the sky and putting it somewhere where the sun doesn't shine and where it's not going to come back out again.
Right. Now, so, Gabriel, a lot of people would say, yeah, that's all very well and good, but, you know, hang on, shouldn't we just stop putting carbon into the atmosphere? Why do we need to take it out? And this is in the parlance of our podcast. How fucked are we if we don't take it out of the atmosphere, even if we do everything else right in terms of climate change?
Okay, so here's the thing, and I completely understand this. One of the reasons that many of my friends in the climate movement are very kind of anxious and suspicious about carbon removals is it sounds like a kind of big techno fix. It sounds like you sort of say, oh, we don't need to worry about anything else. We can just take the pollution back out of the air, and then we can just carry on with business as usual. We can carry on emitting, and that's all fine. And it's a very real fear, and it's a very reasonable fear. People have found all sorts of technologies where they said, don't worry, at some point in the future, we can fix things, we can do that. And then they don't. And then we get more effed as you just put it.
It's very polite of you. I, given that I know you, I can't believe you're shying away from the word fuck here, Gabriel.
Yeah, well, see, I was taught at a convent school, and apparently I swear like a convent girl, so I don't want to mortify myself. So that's a very real fear. And so that's one of the reasons that we haven't really been focusing on what to do about actually taking CO2 back out of the sky. Because, you know, it's obviously, we shouldn't have made this mess in the first place. We shouldn't have been putting so much into the air. But here's the other part of that problem. It's that if you sort of say, okay, well, we've gone too far, but we still can't talk about it because we should still be trying to stop ourselves from going too far, then that just makes things worse and worse and worse. And at the moment, the really bad news is that we have left it too late to stop emissions. We just have. I wish we hadn't. I started working on climate change more than 20 years ago, and we knew then what the problem was. And we still haven't turned that curve around of emissions. Hmm. And so now we've left it too late. We've run out of runway. We cannot get down to zero emissions fast enough to stay below that limit of 2 degrees C that the world actually set as a target, and certainly not 1.5 degrees, which is what we really need to aim for.
I like to think of it as like, you know, the removal van metaphor. You know, if you're moving house, or in this case, trying to manage the house of the planet better, you know, you get the removal firm in and you don't want to be singing, "My old man said, follow the van down the road." But you also need to get Marie Kondo in to do the minimalization of all your stuff before you try and move. So, you know, we've got to move, but we've also got to minimalize the emissions in the first place, haven't we?
I like that analogy just because it gave an opportunity to go into my old man's which is actually, I literally walked through London the other day listening to that. I don't know how you knew. Do you have a tracer on my phone or something?
Wow, well, I mean, it's a convent girl thing, isn't it?
Very probably. Anyway, I'm not sure about the moving analogy. I think maybe a better analogy is cleaning up our own mess.
Yeah.
It's like, so first of all, if you go to a picnic spot and you find that it's completely full of rubbish, you might put a sign up saying no more rubbish here, or you might have people on hand to say, don't throw anything else away, don't throw any more rubbish out. You might actually stop people throwing more rubbish and making it worse, but you've also got to clean up what's there. And so I think that's a better analogy for thinking about carbon removal. So we've got to stop putting more CO2 in the atmosphere. We absolutely have to do that as fast as we possibly can. And at the same time, we've got to clean up what's there. And so that takes me to the other part of it, which, well, this is just a bit more heartening. I want to start on a slightly heartening note, even though I know we're supposed to go bad before we get better. Because if we can really pull off carbon removals, it stops the problem getting worse, because you can actually, you can balance all the emissions that we otherwise can't do anything about. Like at the moment, we've got all this emissions from flights, from aircraft. We don't have a good solution for them. We've got emissions problems from heavy industry. We've got all these places where it's really hard to fix them. And so if we start doing carbon removals now, we can balance that. But if we carry on, we can actually clean up the mess and solve the problem that we've caused. And that is really heartening.
Now, I'm going to pull us back on track here, because you can't go on our show and start making people feel happy in the first half, okay? Because that's just not part of the rule.
All right, it's really hard to do it. It's really, really hard and expensive. How about that?
I want to douse your optimism with some cold, hard facts here, if I may, Gabriel. I think if we look at sort of pretty much any scenario, to get to net zero by 2050, we've got to remove something like 200 billion tonnes of CO2 from the atmosphere. Is that about right?
That is roughly right. The Energy Transition Commission have done that calculation, and they've worked out it's a cumulative amount between now and 2050, and we'd have to carry on removing about 10 billion tonnes a year after that.
Yeah. Now, to put that into perspective, that weighs about the same as 10 million cubic metres of gold. So that is quite a lot of CO2. How much can we remove right now?
Brace yourself. So remember that number. We're looking for 200 billion tonnes cumulatively between now and 2050. Today, we're removing maybe 2 million?
Mm. 2 million. Mm. Okay. I think your team did an analysis of all the people that are in this space, the people who are in that carbon removals market, and they was, and sort of said, like, well, what do you all think you can do by 2030? And they said 24 million tonnes.
It was roughly that.
So even by the end of the decade, and so that is against 200 billion that we need to by 2050. So we're monumentally fucked, aren't we? There's no way out of this, surely.
Incorrect. And I will fight anyone who says otherwise. I'm going to pour my optimism into your vast pit of doom, no matter what you tell me.
Okay.
Because here's the thing. The only way we're guaranteed to be fucked in this is if we don't actually do anything about it. And one of the cool things that can help us is this whole exponential curve thing. So we've learned a lot about exponential curves in the pandemic, how fast things can turn around. And it also works in technology too, that what we have to do is figure out how we can get onto the exponential curve of doubling and doubling and doubling and doubling in the amount of carbon that we're taking out of the sky and finding places to store. So we did a calculation with the UN High Level Champions for Climate Action. They're the guys that kind of marshal all of the, what they call the non-state actors, not the government negotiators, but everyone else for the COP process. And my team have been partnering with them on a program called Rethinking Removals. So we did this calculation about if we want to get to that kind of amount, 200 billion by 2030 and 10 billion a year after that, what do we need to do by 2030? How do we get onto an exponential curve that keeps doubling and doubling and doubling? And we came to the conclusion that what we need by 2030 is around 100 million. So it's around 100 million. That means doubling every 2 years between now and 2030. Now, that's hard. It's really hard, especially since at the moment the commitments are only around the 24 million mark. But from 24 million to 100 million isn't so terrifying. And so basically what we need to do now is put a rocket under all of this, figure out what's stopping it, unleash entrepreneurial energy, do the thing that will make the thing happen, and also make sure that we're not so frightened of it, that we can build in from the beginning, that everything that might go wrong about it, we can actually try and preempt and start off. Right. I mean, one good thing about this is that it's completely blank slate. So you can actually start with the right principles if you're careful.
Why are we doing that? I mean, slowly seems harsh. And I'm interested in, like, having worked in the field for 20 years, how your optimism levels are in terms of, I guess, progress has been slow, but is it an exciting time now? Do you feel that we've made as much progress maybe in the last 2 or 3 of those 20 years as we have in the 16 or 17 before?
In climate generally, or in carbon removals, or both?
Climate generally, I think.
So why have we moved so slowly, and how do I feel about it? I just don't call myself an optimist, because I feel like optimism, you know, optimism and pessimism, they're fatalistic. Basically, you think the future's going to be whatever it's going to be. And if I'm generally a sunny kind of person, I'll assume it's going to be good. And if I'm generally a kind of miserable kind of person, I'll assume it's going to be bad. But I don't have any agency to change it. And so basically, we can't predict the future, but we can create it. And that particularly applies to climate change, and it particularly applies to carbon removals. And so just generally in climate, I have never seen, we're going at warp speed. In the last like 2 years, I was completely gobsmacked because I really thought that we were getting some momentum. Finally, we were really getting some action finally. And then along came COVID and I thought it was all going to go crashing and burning and everyone will forget about climate and then we'd be in real trouble. But in fact, the opposite happened. In fact, if anything, the whole system accelerated. People were resetting. They were taking the opportunity to reset and doing stuff that they'd intended to do in 5 years and doing it now. And one of the biggest reasons for that has been the whole business and investment side of this. They're the guys that can actually deliver the solutions and you know, follow the money. The investors have begun to realize that their money's at risk, that we're already, this whole thing is already underway, that the world is already burning, that's already a risk to the whole economic system. But there's a big opportunity for businesses to find the solutions. And so I found that I give a lot of keynotes and I've been speaking more and more to people in the financial services sector who are saying, we need to get behind this, we need to understand it. And it's getting more and more mainstream. So that's meant that in the last 18 months, 2 years, I've seen an acceleration like I've never seen before in solutions, in really what do we actually do about this. But I've also seen an acceleration in anger, in rage, in frustration, in polarization, in kind of my solution and not yours, in it's got to be pure, it's got to be perfect, in this sort of massive divide between the people who are putting the energy into the climate story, who are the climate activists, and the people who can deliver the solutions, who are the business and finance. And so I feel like right now we're at this cusp of big opportunity to solve it and also big risk of polarizing ourselves.
Mm. We've obviously all watched Don't Look Up. What would you say to people who sort of make the connection between the Mark Rylance character in Don't Look Up, you know, with the sort of commercial opportunity and global salvation type of intervention, which obviously didn't work out exactly brilliantly in the movie. You know, is that a simplistic connection to make?
Yeah, well, what I'd say, I mean, I really enjoyed the movie. If by enjoyed you mean screaming, jumping up and down.
Yeah, I think we all enjoyed it like that.
Yeah, I would have two kind of criticisms of the movie. They were a little bit different from other people's, having said how much I enjoyed it. I think, it was very funny, and the pot shots that it took at the kind of the billionaire terrifying Mark Rylance techno wizard, we can fix it. Oh, no, we didn't. Oh, well, let's go somewhere else. It was utterly chilling. And in a way, to bring us back then to carbon removals, that's one of the issues here, because I think there are three big fault lines that people, as soon as they start to think about carbon removals, immediately kind of stumble across. And one of them is the one I've already mentioned, which is if you think about removing carbon, then that might stop you from actually stopping it getting worse. And the answer is we have to do both. But the second one is this kind of nature versus tech thing that happens in the climate space. And that was kind of exemplified by Mark Rylance's character. In a way, the movie implied that everything, that the way to solve the problem was a techno fix, but Mark Rylance picked the wrong techno fix because he wanted to have commercial opportunity as well. But what, you know, what should have happened is that the government should have done the techno fix. And people have sort of said, yeah, but, you know, techno wizard, we're going to, you know, use technology to solve the problem. It's not the whole answer, but it's still a part of the answer. And this nature versus tech thing is, I've just done a TED talk about this, and I really focused on, and carbon removals, on that whole issue about, do we use nature? Do we use technology? And what I find is people who are on the kind of green lefty side kind of say, well, I like trees, but not the rest. And people are on the kind of right businessy side say, give me techno, but not the rest. And in fact, one of the things that's fascinating to me about carbon removals is every single solution, you can store carbon, get this, you can store carbon in trees, you can store it in soils, you can store it in the ocean chemistry, you can store it in buildings, you can store it in rocks, you can store it deep underground, you can store it all over the place on Earth. And every single one of those solutions is some combination of natural resources and human ingenuity and technology. It's not about wizard techno fix. It's about looking at what the Earth is offering us for carbon storage mechanisms and then figuring out how we can put the carbon there and keep it there. And that really takes a lot of humanity and nature and tech all working hand in hand.
Yeah, I mean, that's the difference, isn't it? I mean, the two angles you might take on that is like whether it's, and I'm conscious of all of these things being, you know, non-binary, but it's whether it's sort of transactional or relational, isn't it? So, you know, an entirely machine-led approach would be very transactional. It's like, well, we just got to suck that carbon out of the air, whereas the relational approach might be a more heart-led technology or a combination, as you talk about, in terms of indigenous wisdom and working with the grain of nature and accelerating those natural processes. And I guess my personal concern is that it becomes very transactional based on the fact that that's where the commercial opportunities might lie.
Well, I think I might challenge that because, I mean, let's give you one example of one particular carbon removal technology, which is biochar. So this is fantastic stuff. It's basically, you take wood offcuttings. What happens is the tree, and I still, by the way, this still blows my mind. Every single tree on earth has made its entire body out of thin air. So every plant, every tree, they're fantastic carbon capture machines. What they do is they take CO2 out of the air and they turn it into the physical stuff. It still blows my mind that they do that. So what you do is you get the CO2 goes from the air into the tree. And then you take the wood or wood offcuttings or whatever, and you burn them with very little oxygen. So they turn into this stuff called biochar, and it looks a bit like charcoal. But the thing about it is the carbon gets locked into the biochar. It can't then escape again. So if you just plant a tree, it's a great carbon capture machine, but there's still a danger that it might burn. If you chop it down, it can rot. And if any of those things happen, the CO2 goes back into the sky. So biochar, once you do that thing where you burn it with very little oxygen, it goes to this kind of charcoaly thing, and then the carbon stays locked. So you've taken it out of the sky, into the tree, into the biochar, done. But then what you can do with it is you can put it in soils. You can, if you plow it into fields, then it actually stays in the field, and the carbon stays in the biochar, but it also improves the quality of the soil. Mm. So you get better agriculture. So you don't need to use as much fertilizer. And it turns out that indigenous people in the Amazon have been using that approach for generations, not to take out carbon from the air, but to improve the quality of the soil. So what have you got there? You've got technology, because you have to do this on a very big scale. You get the wood, you have to transport it, you have to burn it, you have to take it away again, you have to spread it on the fields. So that's a lot of kind of big industry technology type stuff. But you're also improving the quality of the soil and working with nature. You're working with nature. And on top of that, it's indigenous wisdom. Hmm. What is that? Is that transaction? Is that tech? It's all of them together. And I think we need to get a lot cleverer about melding all the things that we do best instead of saying, is it this or is it that?
So, Gabriel, I'm conscious of our listeners here. Listening to that, a lot of people just go, well, why don't we just plant more trees? You know, why do we, you know, a lot of people ask me this, surely let's just plant a trillion trees, and then we're done, aren't we? Why is that not the solution?
Well, I don't think anything is the solution. If only there were. We've all been looking for a silver bullet for decades. You know what? There ain't one. Mm. We have to get over it. This is a systemic issue. And what we've been doing for years, we've been chopping down trees and burning them, or we've been letting trees burn over the decades and centuries. And we've also been pulling fossil fuels out of the deep rock, oil and coal and natural gas, and we've been burning that and putting it into the atmosphere. And that's the way that we've caused this problem, basically. So if we look back at the root of it, so we've been chopping down trees, and that's caused an increase in CO2. We need to plant trees. I love trees. I'm a very big fan of trees. I've even learned to hug a tree, although not when anyone's watching. But we need to plant more trees for different reasons, because we're also facing a biodiversity crisis, and we're also facing a crisis of loss of wilderness in the world. And so it's not just plant trees for carbon. It's also plant trees to figure out how we can address that biodiversity crisis. Make sure you're planting trees of the right species in the right kind of place. And that's not just for biodiversity. It's also because if you plant a tree in the wrong place, where we've already got climate change coming for us, we've already got forests burning. And so if you plant a tree where it's likely to burn, then you plant it, you go through all that effort, burns, CO2 goes back into the sky. Mm. Or if you plant it where it's going to be chopped down because you don't own the land in perpetuity, and you say, I'm very nice, I'm going to keep the tree, and someone else comes along and says, get out of the way, and they're there with a chainsaw. So, you know, if it goes into a tree, it has to stay long enough that we actually start to solve the problem. Mm. So I think it's being clever about how we plant trees so that they address the biodiversity crisis. On top of that, who owns the land where you're putting these trillion trees? What else were they planning to do with it? Mm. There's a social justice and social equity thing about this as well. And on top of that, any solution that relies entirely on kind of global land use change is already mired in really difficult, challenging solutions, because you know, if you're having to try and get one solution that fits all these different very local conditions, then you've already got a problem. And on top of that, there isn't enough land. We've been pulling coal and oil and gas out of the deep rock and burning that, and you can't balance sort of geological carbon with biological carbon. There's just not enough space on Earth. But apart from that, it's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, I remember you told me that your team had done an analysis of just two companies' kind of carbon neutral ambitions, yeah. And they said that, well, we're going to take the carbon out with trees, and you worked out that those two companies alone would have to plant a forest the size of Spain.
Yeah. That's the other thing, they wouldn't plant it in Spain. So it's not, I mean, Spain's massive, yeah. but on top of that, where do they plant it? Do they go to some country in Africa where they've got other need for that land? Or, you know, it's not fair.
And also, I think there's that people forget, there's another really interesting issue about permanence and durability, in that if you plant a tree, it takes a long time to grow, and the carbon you're taking out. So people will buy these cheap offsets, say, oh, I paid $10 or whatever for a ton of carbon. But actually that carbon isn't removed until the tree is fully grown, pretty much. So you've got to wait, you know, 20, 30 years anyway. So it's a very slow way of pulling the carbon back as well.
Yeah. So I really want to reiterate, I'm a very big fan of trees. You've got to be careful and think about
it. We all love trees.
No, but not just that, planting more. We do need to plant more, but that's not the be-all and end-all solution to how we can remove carbon from the sky. It's part of it, but it's a relatively small part.
Is it worth? Because I'm sure I get asked this question a lot. So if trees are great and we should plant more of them, we should plant them in the right places for all the reasons you talk about, but that's not enough given where we are. Could you just run us through some of the other great ways of doing it? So there's biochar. What else is there that we can do?
Yeah, so the kind of poster child for carbon removals, and the one that's let's start at the nature end, the kind of greeny end. So we've got trees, we've got soils as well. I talked about how you can use biochar for soils. One of the problems with putting carbon in soils and having them as an extra carbon store is that often it means that you basically have to treat the land in a different way, basically don't plow. And so you can store it for 1 year, you can store it for 2 years, and store it for 3 years, and then along you come and plow once, and all of that carbon goes back into the sky. So not very big durability. It's a very, very short term unless you can guarantee that you keep approaching it the same way. Hmm. Here's some of the cool things that you can do with the wood. If you're worried about the trees burning or rotting or whatever, you can actually harvest wood, and you can harvest it in a very sustainable way, and then you can do things with it like biochar, but you can also put it in buildings. So this is a new approach. Of course, we've been using wood in buildings for a really long time, but there's now an approach to make modern high-story buildings, modern multi-story buildings out of wood.
Ply scrapers, I think they call them.
Yeah. Ply scrapers. Yeah. And the thing is, think about this. First of all, they capture the carbon in the wood and it stays there because you put it in the building. Secondly, they displace concrete. Cement is one of the biggest emitters of CO2 for making it. 8% of global emissions come from cement. So if you're displacing that, it's already a good thing. And they look gorgeous. They look absolutely gorgeous. So, it's kind of being clever about how we do this. So that's things. Yeah. Then what else can you do? Oh, rocks. So this is cool. So it turns out that the basalt rocks and a few others, they naturally take up carbon dioxide, but unfortunately they take a very long time to do it, like of the order of 10,000 years. So that's not very helpful for us over the next 20 or 30 years. But you can accelerate that process. So the way you accelerate it is you grind up the rock really small, then there's loads of little surface that the reaction can happen on, so it happens a lot faster. And it turns out you can then turn that, it's called enhanced weathering. And it turns out you can do that, and you start to get the take up. Instead of 10,000 years, it can be 1 or 2 years. And if you grind that rock up and you spread it on fields, then that also delivers extra minerals to the soil. So it's another way of making the soil condition better. And then when it washes off into the sea, it can even help to neutralize the acidification of the ocean. So that's a really clever one all around, and it's just being explored.
It's interesting in terms of the kind of the ply scraper piece as well, because, I mean, Mark and I have done a couple of presentations on this to big construction firms, and these ideas of cross-laminated timber, replacing, as you say, the carbon-intensive concrete. But people go, oh, well, wooden buildings don't last. And I always use the example of the Ying Temple in China, which was built in 1056. You know, it was sort of built 10 years before the Norman conquest, and it's still sort of going strong. But, I mean, the question I wanted to ask, Gabriel, is, you know, is part of the reason why we are late to the party. And as you say, there's been a big shift in the last 2 or 3 years because of the way that the carbon removal industry originally emerged, which was largely coming from the techno fix from big fossil fuel giants, from carbon capture and storage, from using the injection of carbon dioxide into old oil and gas fields for enhanced recovery. Do you think that's still a sort of lingering taint, that it was used as a sort of get out of climate change jail free by some of the big players?
Yeah, I mean, I think because I just you busted. I feel thoroughly busted because all of those carbon removals approaches I told you, this is the way I'm approaching this now, talking about it, because I haven't got to the two big ones, the two ones that really can scale massively and then probably be essential part of the solution. And both of those people are very suspicious of. And in both cases, it's because they've come from the end of the kind of techno wizard plus kind of oil and gas industry plus big industry and machines and so on. And that makes people understandably nervous. So the two remaining technologies that I'd highlight at the moment, and there could well be many more, there's this thing called bioenergy carbon capture and storage. That's basically you take wood and instead of turning it into biochar and put it on fields, you burn the wood in a power station. But so you get energy from it, which is good. And then you capture the CO2 that comes out of the chimney and you take it away and bury it. So if you think about that, the CO2 goes from the sky to the tree to the capture in the power station to underground. And so that's a carbon removal, sky to tree to underground. And then the other one, which is direct air capture and storage, which I think is very, very cool and interesting and is just very nascent, is take the CO2 directly out of the sky wherever you put your plant.
When you say plant, you mean not your industrial plant, so your factory. So these are kind of these big machines that directly suck carbon out of the air.
But what they are basically is that the big ranks of fans, so electric fans that will blow air over a capture device. The capture device captures the CO2, and then you take that away, you transport it away, and you bury it somewhere. And when I said plants, though, it is kind of ironic because here's one of the reasons that direct air capture is potentially a really good idea. There's a plant that's been designed in Texas, where first of all the aim is it will take out 1 million tons a year. One plant will take out 1 million tons a year. And that's the equivalent of 40 million trees, but it just takes up the space of a kind of a factory. So that's a way to use land very efficiently, and you can obviously put it anywhere. It doesn't depend on whether there's available kind of sunlight or water, all the things that trees need. But also, what's clever about that is I love the poetry of this. It's like reversing the valve because it's right on top of the places that Texas oil was brought out of, and so it's kind of like the oil came out and made the CO2, and so now you're taking the CO2 and you're putting it back where it came from. And so those two approaches, I think, are going to be very important for getting the scale that we need. And yet, just as Ed mentioned, there's a big trust issue here. It's like, who are the people who are doing it? Do we trust them? We don't really like tech, so let's go back to nature. And I would love to do that. I really would. I'd love to do that. If only it would work, I'd really love it. But we're too late, and there's just not enough.
Yeah, I mean, is this like a health metaphor, though? So, you know, we talk a lot about the fact that the healthcare system is not really a healthcare system. It's a sick care system, you know, because it doesn't have the upstream intervention. And if you like, is this whole emergent, nascent carbon removal essentially some kind of emergency medical intervention, a sort of climate CPR? Because I think there are some people who would also say, isn't this just like the spider to catch the fly? And then we're introducing other more complicated solutions without addressing the sort of the root cause. And I know we've talked about the fact we've got to draw down too, but for me, this is the thing about the relational aspects that we keep meddling, if you like. And we will continue to meddle ad infinitum.
So here's the thing about that. I mean, basically, as Mark kindly pointed out, I'm not sure I like being described as a pointy-headed scientist, but I kind of am. That was my background. And so basically, if in doubt, go to the numbers and see what you need to do. And so if you go to the numbers here, you go, okay, if we want to get down to net zero by 2050, which means every single bit of the economy, every single thing that puts out emissions now is not putting out any net emissions in 29 years' time. So that doesn't just mean electricity. It doesn't just mean having electric cars. It means all of the cement and steel and chemicals and heavy industry and all the trucks and all the planes and all the ships and all the way that we make stuff and everything. the only way to do that right now, we've left it too late. The only way to do that is if, in addition to going, making heroic strides in reducing emissions, we also take 200 billion tons of CO2 out of the sky. And if we do both of those things, we can get to net zero by 2050. If we don't, we can't. So, you know, you might say, well, I don't really like that because it's purple. But bottom line is we have to do both.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what the numbers say. We have no choice. So then the question is, so how do we go about it if that's what we have to do? And how do we try and get it right? And I think the thing about meddling, I just want to say this thing about meddling, because there's another kind of issue here, which is, you know, it's better not to chuck all the litter in the picnic site in the first place. But once you've put it there, as well as stopping putting more, you also have to clean up what's there. And so, you know, it is this both and, but the meddling bit, there's a whole new set of people now looking at this area of geoengineering. I know, why don't we put little mirrors in the sky so that we can reflect sunlight back? I know, why don't we pump aerosols into the upper atmosphere so that we can make clouds that will reflect sunlight? I know, why don't we put iron filings in the ocean so we can make the ocean take up more CO2? Now, those things frighten the living bejesus out of me. They frighten me to death. And I'm going to give you one reason why. Here's a story. Hands up if you've heard of the very brilliant Thomas Midgley.
Oh, hands up. It's a podcast.
Wave your hands in the air.
I'm glad you got the gag, Mark. It's almost like you're a comedian. Thank you very much for laughing.
Almost.
So basically, the very brilliant Thomas Midgley. And this is a different, it was about a different issue, but this, I keep going back to this in my head, this guy. So he was a lovely guy. He's a very clever inventor. And around the turn of the last century, he wanted to help. Things were going wrong and he wanted to help. And he's a brilliant inventor. So he decided, he saw that this newfangled technology of refrigeration, electric refrigeration, was coming along. But they were trying to do these refrigerants that kept bursting into flame or were poisonous. He was thinking, if you put a fridge in a hospital, then you can get medicines better to people. You know, if you have fridges and you can get food to people who need it, it's a really good thing. So he decided to invent a chemical that was completely harmless. It was designed to be completely harmless. He actually designed it so it could not be broken down, so it couldn't possibly do any damage. So, you know, and he was trying to help. And that turned out to be chlorofluorocarbon, which had never existed on Earth before. And that chemical, because it was completely harmless, couldn't be broken down, made it all the way to the upper atmosphere above the ozone layer, where ultraviolet light ripped it apart, turned it into a monster, and it nearly destroyed all life on Earth. Mm. And by the way, poor old Thomas Midgley, guess what he did before that? That was his encore. Before that, he was the guy who figured out that if you could make petrol cars run better if you added lead to the petrol.
What a legacy.
Yeah. Well, as Neil Ferguson, the historian, says, the only real law of history is the law of unintended consequences.
Yeah, exactly.
So what kind of principles could we then introduce? I mean, you alluded to this earlier, Gabriel. Like, you know, as you say, you know, you don't want these unintended consequences, but perhaps, you know, inevitably we're going to encounter some of them. So what are the sort of principles for unfucking that we might make sure that we keep these technologies and these combinations of nature and technology and indigenous wisdom on track?
Well, I just want to say one important thing before I answer that, because I'm making very clear blue water between those kind of geoengineering solutions, that kind of, oh, oops, we did that, we thought it was going to work, and then look, we nearly destroyed all life on Earth, and carbon removals, two completely different things. Because with carbon removals, we put the CO2 in the sky, we can take it back out again. With all these others, we've no idea what will happen if we just kind of tweak around with the atmosphere doing this and that. But here's the thing, if we don't do carbon removals, we're going to get to the stage where our only choice is to start doing this fiddling and this messing. And that's what frightens me. So I think for me, the biggest reason to pour heart and energy into getting the stuff back out of the sky is before it's too late and before we have to do these other things.
Yeah.
That brings me on together, because I think that's something that's really important, which is around the language of this stuff, because, you know, people will click on their flight ordering website or whatever, and it'll say, do you want to offset your carbon emissions, or do you want to pay this small amount of money, blah blah blah. Can you, there's a lot of real confusion I find where people say, what is this an offset, is it what's the difference between offsetting and removing? Can you explain that to us?
So just as I said at the beginning, people sort of say carbon capture, and there's lots of different ways that applies. The same thing with offsets. I actually I offset my life and I thought it would be a good thing to do, and when I finished doing it, I didn't feel better. I didn't feel like I just sort of got away with it. I actually felt slightly sick. The thing about offsets is that here's the idea, and I usually do this by showing my hands, but since you've already pointed out I can't show my hands, I have to do it in words. So one version of this whole thing is that I put a ton of CO2 in the air, and Mark, you put a ton of CO2 in the air. Bad Gabriel, bad Mark, we've got 2 tons of CO2 in the air. So what offsetting does is I put my ton of CO2 in the air, but I say to you, Mark, maybe can you not put out yours and I'll pay you? And then that's, so that helps. But my ton of CO2 is still in the air. So you go from 2 tons to 1 ton, but it's still not zero. And that's what most of the offsets that are being offered, apart from trees, that's what most of the offsets are being offered are. It's basically you pay someone else not to do it, but your ton is still there. And I call that an avoidance offset. It's an avoidance offset. It's one ton that doesn't go in the sky, but one ton still does. Now, a removal is I put a ton of CO2 in the air, and Mark, I pay you to remove a ton. So my ton goes in, your ton goes out, and we get to zero. It's basically what comes up must now come down. And that gives you the answer where you can actually get to zero. So I think we're going to have a very big shift. At the moment, almost all offsets are that kind of avoidance offset. And we need to shift that to removing it. If you put a ton in, you need to take a ton of CO2 out.
Okay, so talking about how fucked we are, and you're starting to sort of unfuck us by saying there's all these various ways of doing it. But a common argument is, and it's a very valid one, is, for instance, if you look at taking it directly out of the air, the direct air capture machines, it's phenomenally expensive. It's something, depending on who you talk to, it's between sort of $400 to $1,000 per ton of CO2 taken out, which, you know, so a lot of people say this is a ridiculous, expensive, unproven technology that will never get to where we need to get it to. So, you know, it's just another techno utopian fantasy that is stopping us dealing with the real problem.
So it is very expensive, and lots of the other approaches are very expensive too, because they take a lot of energy. It takes a lot of energy to power those fans. It takes energy. You have to, you know, if you're doing BECCS, you need to chop down the wood, you need to transport it, you need to burn it, you need to transport the CO2, you need to bury it, and you need to make sure it stays down there. And so, and then lots of the other, you know, if you're doing biochar, if you're doing enhanced weathering, you need to grind up the rock, that takes energy, you need to transport it, you need to spread it on the fields. So it is expensive at the moment. But the way to get these things down the cost curve is actually to invest in them now. And when I say get them down the cost curve, we all know it happened with solar, it happened with wind. You know, people would say, oh yeah, but they're all too expensive, so we can't possibly do it, so let's just carry on as we are.
Yeah.
And now solar and wind are cheaper than coal. So that's part of the answer. But the other part of the answer is a challenge back to you. Okay, so if you say, no, let's not do that, what's your plan? What's your alternative? Because remember, 200 billion tons, you can't get away from it. And the more you ignore it, the bigger it gets. Every ton of CO2 we put in the air today is another ton we have to take out. So if you don't like it, what's a better plan? And there isn't one.
What are the options for, I mean, it seems like carbon drawdown, as you say, is just inevitable. We have to do it and we have to invest heavily in it. And this is a podcast, I guess, about systems and how connected everything is. Is, given that this is an industry that has to have massive investment, and I'm looking at an article now with the headline, Wealth of 10 Richest Men Doubled in Pandemic, is there a possibility for carbon drawdown to become an industry that levels up in other areas, so that investment and that technology goes into countries which need development and need empowering in terms of solving the climate crisis?
I am so glad you asked that, because that's actually the third fault line. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned already there's one fault line that we've identified, which is the if you do removals, you don't do emissions reductions. And I said we have to build in from the beginning, a principle from the beginning, we have to do both. And then the second one was the nature versus tech, and we talked about how the different technologies or different approaches actually involve both. But the third one is loosely speaking, I call it the global north, global south, or the inequity one, that the carbon removals are kind of perceived as something for industrial nations and not for the rest. And actually, we're working with this very brilliant guy, James Mwangi, who has just founded a thing called the Climate Action Platform for Africa. He's Kenyan, and he's an absolute genius, and so is the team. And they're saying, actually, if you look at the different parts of Africa, have fantastic carbon storage possibilities, but they're not being used for direct air capture at the moment because it takes a lot of renewable energy. It takes a lot of energy to power those fans. So he said, well, what if we can actually find places in Africa? We've got a young workforce that's very entrepreneurial. We've got resources. So what if we find places where we can actually build the renewable energy that's needed to power the direct air capture, use one of these storage facilities, and then use the leftover renewable energy to lift people out of poverty and actually to grow the economy? He's saying that rather than thinking about the continent of Africa as a kind of victim of climate change, this could be an engine of growth for countries that really need that engine of growth. Because we're starting from the beginning with this whole industry, we actually have the chance to say, never mind saying it has to just, the money has to go into those pots. Let's make sure that we both get the scale that we need and get the justice that we need at the same time.
I'm still, in terms of the technologies and the massive investment needed, and I'm very wary of not asking whether to be optimistic or not, because I feel like we've talked about that at length. But in terms of what the next, you know, you've talked about the masses that's going on and the technologies that exist and how much innovation there's been in the last 2 years. What does the next 2 years look like, possibly, in terms of, you know, concrete progress?
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word concrete. we don't want concrete progress.
Cross-laminated timber progress.
Yes.
We want to decarbonise concrete, so that's all right. I totally approve of decarbonising concrete. Anyway, so what do the next 2 years look like? I mean, basically, at the moment, there's a lot of really entrepreneurial energy going into this. There's a lot of startups. There's a lot of different people looking at different approaches. There's a lot of venture capital going into this. There is a danger that some of these kind of narratives, some of these fault lines will actually derail it from people who are very suspicious. And so I think that what we need to do, first of all, in the next few years is have much better conversations, much better, humbler conversations about how can we make sure this is a very broad church and everyone gets behind the way that it needs to happen. So that's one, and my team and I are working on that, how we can actually have those conversations so we get all of the issues on the table and make sure we have the right design principles from the beginning to ensure that we can assuage those challenges. And then the other thing is to drive money to where the investment's needed and figure out what all the problems with that are. And at the moment, one of the things that makes it harder to drive the money and harder to build the trust is we don't have the kind of the standards and the certification and the methodologies. It's very kind of number crunchy, spreadsheety stuff, but we don't have that yet. It's all a bit of a free-for-all and a bit of a wild west. And so I think what needs to happen in the next 2 years is people who really have the right track records, who are just trying this on the ground, figuring out what works and what doesn't, and helping figure out what frameworks we need around it, at the same time as the financiers actually figuring out what they need for their models, the climate activists figuring out what they need to be able to rely on this and put trust in this and put energy behind it. And I think in 2 years' time, we'll really know whether we're on the bottom of that exponential curve or not. Have we actually doubled the projects within 2 years, and if we haven't, what do we need to do about it? So that's where I think that the positive energy needs to go, not the kind of, I don't like it, none of us likes it, but if we pull this off, we can just not just get down to net zero, but we can go back.
And is that the thing that the individual can do? Because there's a danger, I guess, as well, that listening to this, you sort of think, oh, well, it's in hand, people are dealing with it, it's going to become a big industry.
Yeah. I mean, there is a part of this, which is, you know, the experts need to do their expert thing. But what all of us can do, I mean, it's really the trust gets built by engaging with this, by talking about it, by thinking about it, by having the kind of conversations that can help to open up what really scares you, what really worries you, and what can we do about it. And that requires a lot of micro conversations. But maybe more importantly, I think this is something that within the next year or so, everyone's going to be able to take part in this, in that instead of offsetting your emissions, actually buying into carbon removals, that they're much more expensive, but there's lots of ways that you can do it where you kind of blend different removals. And there's lots of companies springing up to do this. There's lots of organizations. In fact, I'm working on one of those myself, and it's to try and make this easy so that we can all start to remove the emissions that we make. And the reason that that's a good idea is that at the moment we don't have enough removals. We don't have enough, 2 or 3 million a year. But if those companies that are trying to make it happen get enough confidence, if they get money, people saying, I'll put the money in now and you remove it in 2 years' time, then they can get the financing to be able to scale. They can get the confidence to be able to scale. And that means that we'll actually have a better chance of getting on that exponential curve, and everyone can do that. So kind of, I feel like it's a bit bit disappointing to say watch this space, but I think within the next 6 months, it's going to be all over the place. Watch out for it and be ready to contribute in if you can.
Yeah, because otherwise we're just repeating the mistakes of the past, aren't we, where these things are done to us or for us rather than with us. And I think they've definitely got to be done with us.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem we have is because we've left it so late and we now have to do this, we have to do it very, very quickly. And in a way, there's a really good parallel with the COVID vaccine, which is lots of financial wizardry went around that to say, if we pay for this stuff in advance, can we fund the research to buy it when it's made? Which is a very concentrated way of getting money into something. And you don't normally do that. You normally wait to buy something because it's already there and you take it off the shelf and you already know it exists. Whereas with the vaccines, we bought them collectively as governments before they'd even been developed, which allowed the researchers to go and put the investment in to create the vaccines at scale and the manufacturers to make them. And we need to do the same with carbon removals.
In fact, it's funny you should say that, because actually a few of the carbon removals guys that we're working with have actually started working with an academic economist who worked on the vaccine forward purchasing to say, how can we do that for carbon removals as well? So it's a brilliant analogy. It's exactly what we need to do.
One of the things that I know you've been working on is getting us to talk about removals in something called NDCs, which is hugely important and very jargony. Can you explain to us what an NDC is and why we need to get removals into them?
NDC stands for Nationally Determined Contributions, and it's a United Nations language, so it shows how very brilliant they are at communications. And they invented this as a way that every individual government could sort of say, sort of from the bottom up, what they were going to do to contribute to the overall target of getting down to well below 2 degrees C. So each government says, well, I'm going to do this to contribute to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And so if you add them all up, added up all of the nationally determined contributions that were taken to Paris in 2015, it didn't add up. It went to something like around the order of 3 degrees. And I think that was an underestimate. And it still doesn't add up after the COP that happened in Glasgow. But each government is supposed to be now ratcheting those up, bringing them back every year, saying, okay, we've tried again. It's like you didn't do your homework well enough, try harder. And that's what the NDCs are. And at the moment, they don't incorporate carbon removals. So they're just basically different ways that you can stop the problem getting worse, different ways that you can try and reduce emissions. But no government in the world is going to be able to do this without carbon removals for all the reasons that we just talked about. And yet they're not thinking about how they can put carbon removals into their NDCs. Now, if you do that, especially if you're a developing country, if you're looking at the opportunities that this entirely new industry might provide to you, there's an extra incentive to put this in your NDCs, because it's not just that this is actually a way of helping you get to your final answer of the number that you need, but it's also a way to look at how you can grow economically in the country as well.
Mm-hmm. There's a great quote, I think it's by Maynard Keynes, who said, it's a perfectly reasonable way to stimulate an economy is to get a whole bunch of people to dig holes and then pay a whole bunch of other people to fill them in. And it strikes me that if we get this industry sort of off the ground, and we've kind of done that, but just over a period of time, we dug the holes and to stimulate the economy with all the energy we got. And now we're creating another huge industry to fill in those holes, which actually, if we get it right, could be an economic boom.
It could be an economic boom, and that's really the only way that we're going to make it happen. Because if this is only a kind of waste disposal system, then as soon as something else comes along, it could get sort of thrown out. And so I think we need to figure out not just how to do it right from the point of view of social justice, not just how to do it right from making sure that carbon removals goes hand in hand with emissions, and not just how to get it right by making sure it's the right combination of natural resources and human ingenuity, but also how to make sure it sustains without it just all that money going to the pocket of the few billionaires.
I know that you and I talk about this sort of stuff a lot, and there's a bit in your TED talk, which I really advise everybody to go and watch if they want to understand this stuff, where you talk about perhaps, you know, one of your favourite experiences in carbon removal that kind of gave you a great deal of hope, and it involves woolly pigs, I believe. Could you tell us that story?
Yes. Who knew that woolly pigs would be such an essential part of this overall story? But I went to a place on the Isle of Mull, which is the Future Forest Company, and they were doing various different kinds of carbon removal. I thought I wanted to go and visit and see how they were doing it. And when we arrived there, the first thing the guy did before we did anything else, we drove along to the estate where they were doing all these different carbon removals. He said, "Let's go find the pigs." I'm like, "Pigs?" Yeah, right. So he's like, come on, you have to. And we parked the car, we ran along the road. I think they're over here. He's going, pig, he was shouting in a Scottish accent. And then we come on to this bit and there's these woolly pigs. This whole snorting, fabulous, big, great big noses, big floppy ears covered in woolly fur, woolly pigs. And I did not see that coming. So I said, what's this all about? And he said, oh, you see, we're looking at planting trees here, and we are planting trees, but we use the pigs because there's been selective grazing. So you've got this head high bracken, and none of the native trees can actually grow. So we bring the pigs in because it's the closest you can get to a native wild boar without having to have a dangerous animals license. And they do what the wild boars did, which is they rootle up all of the kind of the bracken, and they rootle up the undergrowth, and they lift the seed bank to the surface, and they give the native trees a chance to start growing. So the woolly pigs are helping the native trees start growing, and they're planting native trees. So that's, you know, so far so natural. But then they were also doing enhanced weathering. So they've got a local quarry where they've got basalt, so they're grinding that up and looking to spread that on the fields. And then they were also doing biochar. They were getting wood offcuts and they're burning that. So they had machines and they had nature and they had trees and they had woolly pigs. And they were thinking about biodiversity and they were also thinking about machines. And it was all there in one place. And when I saw that, I just thought, this is what it can be like. This is how we can solve the problem and not just get us to net zero, but go beyond and actually fix it and actually start to heal the climate. And that was just, you know, in the words of this podcast, it was fucking awesome.
I love the fact that we've now had the last two episodes as we're wrapping up series three, where we've had John Alexander talking about rutting pigs and you talking about rootling pigs. And I never realized that pigs were such an integral part of a better future, but I think it's a wonderful thing.
It's essential.
There's a reason my band is called Quantum.
Pig. Hey!
Gabriel, I think we should thank you there.
That was great. That was great.
Absolutely amazing.
Thank you. So that was amazing, Gabriel. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
You're very welcome.
So there we go. How are you feeling after the interview about it, Ed? How do you feel about the what Mark described as a slightly more combative nature to your tone there?
Well, I find Gabriel very persuasive, you know. But I must admit, I'm still a bit conflicted. You know, on my other podcast, my friend Dougal Hind always says that some of this stuff is like wishing on space hardware, because as you say, we've got to kind of grow this stuff exponentially and it's expensive and it's difficult at the moment. And I'm still sort of slightly torn as to whether this is brutal pragmatism. You know, as Gabriel said very compellingly, that, you know, we have to do both. We don't have a choice in this. We've got to sort of knuckle down. But I'm still, I guess, slightly haunted by that, you know, the commercial opportunity of making big money by solving big problems. And I think, you know, we've got a situation here where some of the nature-based solutions are already involving a new sort of tranche of carbon colonialism. I mean, Oxfam said that we need five times the size of India to do this, which is also pushing up land prices and disenfranchising local people.
But that's Gabriel's point about that. That's why you shouldn't be sort of just planting trees everywhere, because you're taking off other people. So,
but it's not just trees. It's, you know, it's nature based solutions in the whole. So I'm wary. I mean, I think we've got to do it. You know, we don't like it, but we need it. It's a bit like a kind of unlubricated colonoscopy. It's not going to be comfortable. It's going to be awkward, but it might just save us. And so it comes back to this really key thing. It's like, it's unregulated, it's the Wild West, we've got to get on top of it and make sure it's just not another layer of extractive capitalist colonialism which keeps creating other unintended consequences.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I love Gabrielle so much, because she's actually, you know, in that fight. You know, she's the person who went to COP26 to get those dialogues going about how do we get all that stuff going in an equitable and sensible and standards-based way. Because, you know, you're absolutely right. At the moment, you know, there's people selling snake oil and these dodgy offsets and claiming this and allowing people to get out of jail for free and all that kind of stuff. And you know, but the science, she said, you always go back to the figures. The science says we need to do it, whether we like it or not, and whether we like how it's been done at the moment or not. We have to do it, so let's try and do it as well as we can. And that's what she's dedicating her life to, and for that I can only admire her.
Yeah, absolutely. So that brings us on to our earthly confession for this week. This one comes in from Nick Bedford, or see if you can guess where he's from me saying his name in his accent, Nook Buttfoot.
Sorry.
Do it again.
Nook Buttfoot. Right, I'll read up to the point he reveals and then I will switch seamlessly into his own voice. And it'll be freaky for Nick because he'll think, I only emailed in, but it sounds like I've left a voice note. Firstly, I just want to say how much I enjoy the podcast. It's a great way of changing how I think about the world and interact with it. I listen mostly while I'm at work, which leads me to my confession. I live in New Zealand. Brackets, use accent, please. There are two important factors that relate to my job.
He spent some time in South Africa, by the sound of
it. He has. He travels a lot, which we'll come on to. This is the most specifically targeted accent I've ever used. One of the two factors is that we have no native land mammals, and the second is that most resource constants for big projects such as housing developments or quarries, or new highways, etc., mitigation, planting of native trees, I've gone to Australia now, and grasses, must be done to offset any damage to land or help protect wetland areas. So for my job, I do lots of planting throughout the winter months, roughly around 40,000 plants a year. Throughout the year, we need to do pest control, which involves the trapping of things like possums, stoats. I've turned into Dame Atma. Possums, stoats, ferrets, weasels, and cats to protect the biodiversity of an area. And then in the summer months, we spray the invasive weeds which get into the planted areas. My confession is I have to drive around in a big ute, a big 4x4 pickup, as you call them, which has a diesel engine, and then go killing animals and spraying chemicals everywhere.
You got FW de Klerk.
Oh, no, the end result is great, and we are turning farmland back into native forest or restoring wetlands. But I feel guilty about the process of getting there.
I bet he did too.
There we go. A little world tour there. Carbon neutral world tour.
Do you know what's really interesting about that confession is, in a way, it kind of echoes the conversation we've just had, which is like sometimes, you know, to get to where you need to go, like if you're trying to restore farmland, you might have to use, say, technology that's only at the moment powered by fossil fuels. Or I covered sustainable rice farming in my last book, and it's all about reducing, you know, the use of fertilizer and all that kind of stuff. But occasionally it's like, actually, we need to use a little bit of fertilizer here because that will really help things along. So it's that kind of like where the balance is being drawn between, you know, sort of the bad stuff in one corner and the natural stuff in the other. And actually, if you use them wisely together, they can work very well. And I think he's probably suffering that same sort. I think I'm doing a good thing, but actually it's a bit like a sausage. When I look inside, it's not great. But the sausage tastes great, but I'm not quite happy about how it's being made. And I think actually that's something that we all feel. And it's something that, you know, when you're engaging with the future, which is a contact sport, sometimes, you know, I mean, I would never thought I'd find myself working with the Ministry of Defence or talking to the Foreign Office or working with the big mining company. And that's difficult sometimes. But if you're basically trying to steer things in the right direction, you believe you can use those levers and you keep pure to your purpose, which is making the world more sustainable, more equitable, more humane, more just, more regenerative, then you're always going to have those problems. So, you know, I think I absolve him of his guilt and say, if you like the guy previously, if you feel that, then obviously the next time the option comes up to replace your ute, then, you know, get an electric one and slowly move that thing over. You know, you're on the right path.
It's funny. It's like, it really reminds me, because obviously New Zealand has that particular challenge, doesn't it, of all of these invasive or introduced mammals, which quite happily eat all of their flightless birds.
Yeah, and they also have that massive challenge of people doing their accent really badly, which annoys the fuck out of them.
How the fuck?
No, I remember my oldest girlfriend, Tom Scott, who worked as an ecologist for years, and he volunteered in a New Zealand nature reserve many moons ago. And he was working with this ranger, and they were in the middle of this beautiful forest, and Tom was sort of like, you know, wrapped by all the biodiversity, and it was incredible. And there was a sort of scuffling in the undergrowth, and the ranger went, oh, hang on a minute, mate, and picked up a tire iron out the back of the ute and literally went and bludgeoned a possum to death right in front of them, because obviously you have to control them. And Tom was just like, you know, absolutely horrified at this moment. But you know, obviously there's probably better ways of dispatching them. But that's the kind of stuff that often goes on.
Why do you have to control possums?
Because they're invasive.
Oh, I see. Are they?
They're from Australia. They're not indigenous to New Zealand, and they eat all the birds' eggs.
But I mean, they don't do that when Australians come into immigration, do they? Just get a tire iron out, go, "You're invasive species." Crack the Australians over the head. I mean, there must be a more humane way of dealing with the situation.
And I think that answer speaks to how important your work with the Foreign Office is. You know,
yeah.
we can only wonder what immigration policy would be were it not for the secret work of Barry Smells. And we're grateful to both of you for all you do. So you can email us in with your confessions. Again, we always love hearing what you're doing when you listen to the podcast and all your suggestions for topics, which are gratefully received and noted down. And here's how you can reach us. You can reach us by email at hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. That's hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. We have our own show Twitter account, which is @JandTheF. And of course, you can reach us individually on Twitter too. I am @RonRichardson, John Richardson with the first letter swapped around. That's what I've done there. And you can reach Ed and Mark at the following.
I'm Ed Gillespie @FruCool, which is @FRUCOOL.
And I'm Mark Stevenson, and you can find me @OptimistOnTour.
Next week, we'll be back with a fantastic guest, John Alexander, and we'll be talking about the future of citizens. That's going to be episode 10, and I tell you what, I'm going to remember that. So you enjoy the start of the next podcast. Mark and Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you, John. It's always a pleasure. I just want to flag before we end the show that Gabriel actually has just got a TED Talk out about everything that we have been discussing, which is 11 minutes of kind of... So if you can't be fagged to listen to all of us rambling on, then that's 11 minutes of
yeah,
it condensed.
I was gonna say, well done for putting that at the end of the podcast, not the beginning. By the way, if you don't want to listen to this hour-long chat, she's done a lovely 11-minute TED Talk without us in it.
It is great, though. It's a really good summary, and it's worth, you know, if you want to explain this to other people, it's a really good way of saying that's kind of it in a 10-minute burst.
Have a wonderful week, everyone. Thanks, as ever, for downloading and listening. If you have a moment to pop us a review, that's always very helpful for us on wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.